My name's Eli, and this is Kaz and Hilton. We're going to talk about, the name of this workshop is what? I actually don't know.
Sex, gender, and
power.
And power, yeah.
And power. All right. We're just going to start off with some introductions. My name's Eli Robinson. I grew up here in Montpelier, Vermont. I live in Brooklyn now. I'm 24 today. Thanks. I guess I officially came out as a homo when I was in 9th or 10th grade, but I would say that my lifetime has been spent much less coming out as homo, which wasn't actually that complicated for me, but coming out as a woman, which I was born and raised as, but for whatever reason hasn't really come off to most strangers. So I think the issue that I'm especially thinking about lately within gender politics, which I'm definitely involved in, and very involved in the trans community, and is my own identity as a woman who allies with trans-identified people, just due to the mistakes that have been made in my own identity. This has been I think I'm on the fourth wave of feminism, but I don't know yet. That's yet to be seen. But first, I would premise that gender politics have been very big in my life, and I spend a lot of time especially working with people who identify with changing or adjusting the gender normative and also the heterosexual normative. That becomes revolutionary in that once you identify outside of the norm, everything gets tied in, and oppressions throughout the world, I think, play into that. I don't think that's anything too surprising, but if anybody has questions about that, I think we should talk about it here. So that's kind of where I'm at, and this is my latest this week conversation that I've been having, is how do I identify as a woman who appears often as other than a woman within trans-identified politics, but not identifying as trans. It gets kind of detailed. That's it. So that's me.
My name is Kazembe, can anyone hear me?
Yeah.
All right, good. All right. And I've kind of prepared a few, remarks because, today I've been, asked to talk about, queer identity and this relationship to power and gender, and it's something that's really dear to me, as a black gay man, someone who identifies as queer, who right now is struggling with masculinist notions. Found within various liberation movements. My personal and political project has always been to bring in and usher in those marginalized voices, particularly those voices of black queer people and our presence within liberation movements. I think that, once you think about the history of African Americans within this country, African Americans of gay, lesbian, trans African Americans have always been a presence, whether you talk about the home renaissance, which I like to say was as purple as it was black, people like Langston Hughes and Bessie Smith and Ma Rainey, up to Stonewall with, the transgender sisters like, Sylvia Rivera and there's always been, a presence, a queer presence, and that's kind of reformulated the way we think of liberation, not only in terms of, racial politics, but also in terms of economics and also in terms of our vision of what we want to do in the future. So I kind of prepared these remarks to kind of, look at the kind of critical tensions that are going on in society right now. And just bear with me. I kind of have what one professor called a nutshell style, which is I tend to go, free, then kind of bring it in. So I'm going to sort of attempt it right now. A lot of these talks have been informed by, knowing Eli and Ace, who I hope is doing well, and I'm sure that, Hilton will probably have something much more illuminating to say than I do.
Good job.
Good job. So I want to begin my talk by discussing a few observations on fashion. I know that Tara is doing a talk on fashion, so I'm not trying to take the steam from her or steal her thunder. But, you know, and I don't think I can do as great a job as she can. But, you know, being for that, I'm from New York, you know, fashion is in my genes, so to speak. You know, because I'm always considering that, because I'm like, what the hell am I going to wear today? You know, because, you know, it all matters on the subway.
you know. It is the runway.
Yeah, sure. It is the runway, yes. On the streets of New York City, I've noticed a war of T-shirts. Many people have worn the T-shirts emblazed with the image of Che Guevara, the Cuban revolutionary. Many others have sported the image of Scarface, played by Al Pacino, the drug lord. Now, I want to consider a connection between these two figures in terms of talking about the critical tensions within society at this current historical juncture. And both of these figures were Cubans. Both of these figures were larger than life, mythical yet so real. Both were global in their demands. Che, the Argentinian fighting revolutions in Cuba, the Congo, and Bolivia. Scarface, of course, spoke of global domination. He says, "The world is mine." And both were lovers. Che once remarked, "At the risk of sounding ridiculous, the revolutionary is inspired by great feelings of love." Scarface, of course, had tons of money, but what he really wanted was love, the love of family, which he couldn't have. In fact, the more money he had, the more impotent. How many people actually saw Scarface? Okay, so I'm making cultural references that no one understands. Okay, that's great. That makes me a philosopher. So if I'm going too quickly, and you need to, you know, me to clear up. So go see Scarface. It's a great movie. Please. The reason I'm bringing up these metaphors in relation to gender and sex is because they represent powerful tensions and contradictions within society. That is, the tension between what I call the erotic versus the pornographic. The erotic is what Audre Lorde called that deeply feminine plane of tenderness, caring, and values. And for me, Che upheld these in some respects. At the same time, however, on a political stage, there's a gangster ethos in the foreign policy of this country. One is a type of pornography, where there's a gross violence, a titillation, obscene wealth amidst poverty, and a war against the earth. In the movements, this plays out in our visions as well. Some believe that revolution must entail a disciplining of the body, of gender normativity, and a primary focus on the delivery of social services. And then there's us. We who believe in gender fluidity and erotic beyond pornography, one that comes to style, focus on cultivation, like cooking, play, and a total avoidance of work. I want to engage these celebratory styles that's found in the music of Jill Scott and Biggie Smalls. And, you know, when I think of Biggie, when he said, like, birthdays was the worst days, and that we shipped champagne when we thirsty, you know, that kind of overcoming of the limitations the system has posed on us. And when I think about my own queer identity and how it related to the movement, it was me coming to the movement because I wanted revolution in this country. You know, like, I want revolution like Archie Lord said, I want revolution like a lover. But at the same time, it also marked a sort of coming out and a coming out of a lot of other people who I was involved with. I was a student activist at one point with the at Hunter College, you know, which you finally call UCLA, the University on the corner of Lexington Avenue, you know, and we were a part of a people of color, mostly women collective, and I came out at that period of political engagement, and not only came out of the closet, so to speak, of like coming out as gay, but also came out as, you know, a lot of other women and organizations came out at out of bad relationships, out of addictions, out of various of impediments, you know, and that was part of our political process. And our engagement with anarchism, primarily through the group Love and Rage, which is, you know, I'm good friends with Chris Day, don't hit me, fostered a new sensibility, one that not only encompassed the ideas of social and political revolution and liberation, but one that also looked at things of rejecting gender normativity, of rejecting, of acceptance of the queer space as a space of contemplation of political liberation, and also one that was very much a fertile field that we can include ourselves in our political liberation project. And just to kind of wrap up, currently right now, my work is primarily focused on the writings of Audre Lorde and the Frankfurt School philosopher Herbert Marcuse, and I think both of these writers share the ideas of the erotic, you know, as a force of liberation, of the idea of work as play, an idea that, you know, that not only do we need to overthrow the economic factors of capitalism, but there's something much deeper. And once we get to that deep part of erotic, that we begin to talk about some more gender fluidity and idea of, like, you know, really breaking down these notions of masculine and masculinists and feminists. I'm going to close with some closing thoughts. I'm currently also working on a group of essays called Queering the X, James Baldwin, Malcolm X, and the Third World. And that particular project came out of my need as a black man within revolutionary national circles that were very homophobic. And for me to re-articulate the tradition of gender fluidity within black liberation. So my project was to really look at the context in which James Baldwin wrote about Malcolm X, and he wrote about him in a screenplay, One Day I Was Where I Lost, where he portrays Malcolm in a much more gender-fluid fashion. And indeed, Malcolm's transformation from the Nation of Islam to a global revolutionary took place within the context of really challenging masculinist notions of revolution, because when he was a Nation of Islam, it was very much like the disciplining of the body and the holding of the body as a place that could not contain tenderness or care. Whereas when he became global, you know, and he traveled to Mecca and he traveled to Africa, his observations of brotherhood has a very much a tenderness to it. Like he talks about, at one point of his letters to Mecca, he speaks of men bonding together, of sleeping together, of sharing the same food. You know, that's really much a utopian vision. I think James saw something in that, and Malcolm, and wanted to articulate that and put that to the forefront, you know, of a consciousness in terms of what kind of revolutionary work we want to do. And lastly, I just want to talk a little bit about gender, just a little bit. Hopefully, this will, you know, generate some questions and conversation. What I really want to kind of put forward in terms of like questions toward the audience, towards you, the audience, to my friends and comrades, is, you know, one thing I'm kind of trying to figure out is how do we create spaces of political liberation without necessarily having to discipline the body? How do we create spaces of joy and resistance that actually challenge the power that challenge the power structure? And I think that if we consider the erotic as a framework, we can perhaps transform the language of economism from that of a discussion of the point of production to the point of consumption. I would dare to imagine that identity is not found within class, but within identity to products of cultural and commodity production. And I say that's the same thing with gender as well, that gender is very fluid, and it depends upon, you know, things like gesture, clothing, social scenes, what have you. And I think that within our own values, rather than having a sort of mass-based approach where we are kind of handing out newspapers in the factories or you know, trying to get the big demonstrations, we need to really take up this idea of the point of consumption that we build our movement upon the values of what we consume, and that can be seen within the slow food movement, within food, religion, and particularly in terms of gender, in terms of dance, you know, and fluidity, and within dance and within music. And I would say that these values in which we can uphold perhaps could lead to a reawakening and a revitalization of revolution within this country, not only in the political realm, but also in the personal realm as well. So I'll just leave it at that right now.
I don't really have much to say, partly because I'm really, really tired. And I already presented this morning, and I already heard myself speak, and that was already annoying enough. Mostly because, especially at this conference, I'm always just really excited to hear what other people have to say, and I'm always really impressed, and I always, I guess in a self-deprecating way, just think, wow, everyone here is a lot smarter than me. And you have different insights, obviously, than I have. So I'm really interested in hearing what people have to say about some of these issues and stuff. I thank you for coming and not going to the fashion one. I can't believe the sexuality one was scheduled the same time as the fashion one. But I'm interested in stuff on radical queer communities and more particularly anti-capitalist queer groups and the Ass Pirates, for those of you who don't know, is an anti-capitalist queer group in Montreal with a great slogan that's Sluts Against Capitalism. It's the best name. And I'm currently in the process or hoping to be in the process of starting a similar group in Toronto and getting an anti-capitalist queer group going in Toronto, which I know people have been trying to do for years and years and years. So that's generally what I'm interested in. And then negotiating those spaces and whether or not people find spaces when involved in... Because part of it came from my own experience of being in groups and in collectives that weren't necessarily entitled like queer collectives that I found to be very separate from those that were considered queer groups. And so I was interested in those connections. And you mentioned Malcolm. And there's actually a good film on Bayard Rustin, which... Bayard Rustin, for those of you who don't know, was really integral part of the civil rights movement alongside with King, but he was kept in the shadows, usually, at best, and he was queer. That's my general interest in negotiating that, and personally negotiating that, and I guess coming from Gloria Anzaldúa's work, was highly influential, and sort of negotiating those different spaces and feeling sort of in those borderlands, which calls I can't even read my own writing. So that's what I'm interested in personally, mostly from coming from all different communities and feeling like there were connections between communities, whether or not it was anarchist communities, or anarchist literature, quote unquote, or coming from a lot of theory. And seeing those connections coming from, seeing connections kind of going through Anzaldúa and Butler and Sedgwick and people, and then seeing connections with anarchist literature that seem to be pretty separate, and so kind of making those connections myself. And just generally coming from various communities myself politically, and I grew up as like the high school football jock dating the captain of the cheerleading team. I was like in the horrible, horrible world, and went on to like business, and then came out as exclusively queer, and then came out as bi, and so constant sort of negotiation. So I'm interested in that, but then the connections between communities. I guess that's generally what I'm interested in, and like I say, so I really want to just get feedback on what people's general reflections are on issues of sexuality and queer issues and global justice politics, and whether or not they see a separation, whether or not they see connections. Groups like the Ass Pirates that make connections between anti-capitalism and queer issues. Those that don't, commodification of queer, the in some, I don't know what people, you know, the gay bourgeoisie, you know, and that sort of, you know, that, you know, like the ass pirates come up against a lot of walls in communities. You know, they're just being hyperbolic, and you know, they're exaggerating, and it's unnecessary, and they're ruining the fun, they're ruining the party by questioning, you know, corporate sponsorship, pride, you know. So the questions that they raise, they come up, and then I think in some contexts and in some ways, I think conversely, there are some walls not so big and obvious that we come up against in other groups that consider themselves safe spaces, consider themselves open in terms of sexuality, politics, but don't necessarily practice that. Or there are still subtle ways of exclusion within those groups, I think. See, that's my general experience or feel. Or there still can tend to be, and again, coming from a horrible football background, sometimes there's almost that a similar field or feeling of, you know, the angry, aggressive straight boys doing their thing. And, you know, and in theory and on paper, you know, yeah, sure, it's fine, you're queer, but there isn't necessarily a sense of connections being made in other communities. And, of course, that goes for hopefully just a small handful of people. But, yeah, so those are my experiences, and that's generally what I'm interested in, those connections between queer issues and anarchism and anti-capitalism, and meshing those together and how people negotiate them and whether or not they see any divisions there at all or what sort of connections they see. So that's what I'm interested in. So that's generally what I want to hear from people and feedback and ideas.
Okay. Thank you guys. I heard some things that I agreed with, and I heard some things I don't. Which is cool, because that's, I guess, why we're invited. Because, I mean, one thing that you said that I think that was within context, and hopefully the context made more sense than what I heard, but it was sort of a statement against work. I would flatly dispute that as anything to do with my goals in my life. I see everything as work, and I see that from a Quaker perspective, which is that work is love made visible, and that love is work, and that self-work is self-love, and that self-work is what's required to become an available facilitator in the world of creating change. And I think that we all have the ability to dig ourselves into whatever definitions and titles we need, but I think, and you know, words are like fishnet stockings in this gender politics thing. We get caught on them, and sometimes they snag people and they get help them, and other times they don't, and they bind people in. I feel like it's kind of a tacky, what is the word there? Metaphor? Analogy? Is that a metaphor or an analogy?
No, it's a simile. It's just a
simile. All right. It's been a while since I... So, anyway... I think that where I sit most of the time is I spend a lot of time working against gentrification, which is a complicated, mostly just through conversation, but also through being really active in my neighborhood in Brooklyn on all kinds of levels. I live in an extremely complicated power dynamic of a neighborhood because of race and class, and because of my appearance, I risk a lot talking to people, but I... also because my parents can get away with a lot. This is one thing that I think that everyone needs to acknowledge about themselves, is how much that we can get away with for our appearance. If you have the ability to speak in English, you have an amazing ability to relate to an amazing amount of people in the world. If you have the ability to speak in sign language, or I guess speak isn't to sign, you have an ability to communicate with more people than I do. And I think that this is something we all need to be especially aware of when we're talking about creating change. It's just our physical space that we can take up. And I'm trying to take up more space, honestly, I guess is what's going on. I think as part of the downsizing, like this sort of like personal revolution thing, I kind of let it become a very downsized thing. And now I'm kind of trying to reach out and communicate more with people about more issues. I work a lot within the queer music scene, which isn't really a scene specifically, and it's not really the queer music scene, but I work a lot of bands. I tour a lot with bands, and so I meet people around the country and spend a lot of time playing in venues that are otherwise straight bars. See, meeting people in random tiny towns who would come out to see the show. That's a pretty big deal. That's an exciting thing. So I don't know if that's anything y'all want to talk about, but I think I've spent a lot of time doing what I guess I call outreach, just in conversation and trying to get people to think beyond identity politics, but also not abandon identity politics, which is another thing that, because I mean, with all due respect, I'm not sure that I totally understood where you stood on this.
Don't push it now.
Yeah. this is something that that's kind of what I was bringing up with the gender thing earlier when I was bringing this up. I feel like identity politics within queer world, once you're safe within a queer world, the identity politics are supposed to dissolve. And I do not like that. I find that the capability of that becoming comparable to colorblindness is pretty rapid, and both on basically on any degree of self-definition. I think self-definition is fine. It's also, I think the important thing is to recognize that other people are also fine, and that your definition is also changeable. And definition is just language. We're just making up words to try to hammer out what we believe in. I don't have any problem with people identifying as something, but I think that one thing I'm dealing with right now within queer world is, am I making sense?
Yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, actually, yeah.
All right. So here's something that's been going on for me. I have spent my whole life kind of looking like what for a long time was called a tomboy, and now I guess now it means that I'm a butch. But you know, whatever. Pretty much been wearing the same outfit for the last 5 years. And I washed it though. I did. I don't know. Not really. What's been going on for me is that my whole life I've been probably 50% of the time at least identified by strangers, which are obviously, you know, in mainstream straight world. At least 50% of the time is he or sir addressed. Even when I grew my hair long, it was still sort of like looked like Beck or something. Like it didn't really come off. And so I've been addressed as he or sir in straight world for so long that I think a pretty young age got to the point where I just figured that they were right. When somebody sees me as a he, that's absolutely who they're seeing, and that's all the gender is, and that's okay. So I never disputed anybody on it. And if I ask for a bathroom and they say there's the men's room, I go in the men's room. I don't give a shit. And the women's room the same. This is something that's been going on for so long that I didn't realize how ingrained it is into me that I hadn't noticed until just recently that within queer world this has become a normal reaction as well. That I think through gender politics and as people are heightening their awareness on the possibility of gender identity being separate than other people's assumptions, they're then making assumptions that someone might identify as the non-apparently biological identity. Does that make sense? So all of a sudden, I've realized that for the last 2 years, 50% of the time within queerscapes, I'm addressed as he, and not sir, because that's just not a word that people use outside of business transactions. But I've been called he a lot, and this is something that I felt appreciated in, and also now I'm starting to feel a little bit wary about, because I feel like by accepting this identity, which I'm not, I'm also negating the intentions of people who do make effort to identify with that, and I'm also negating anyone who deals with a prefix politic, or a prefix queerness, prefix American, prefix anything, adding up to resulting in working towards a revolution does not help, I don't think, to completely obliterate the work that people do to express themselves. And this is a very, very paradoxical situation because I'm at the same time not especially feminine or masculine, and I'm not especially interested in being identified as one or another. It's just that I'm becoming aware that I need to apparently identify, just as I became aware that I apparently needed to come out as gay, which I thought was really puzzling when I was a teenager. I was pissed off. You know, it was like, why? I just like people. I think everybody goes through that. If there's ever a question of that, you know, and then you're bi, and then you're gay, or then you're gay, and then you're bi. And, you know, you experiment with it because it's all titled. If you don't experiment with it, then it's never going to start shaping into what you're looking for. I think an important thing to think about is in the utopian society that we all apparently, hopefully, are thinking about and writing about and imagining and talking about, what kind of politics would you hope people would be able to express for identity politics? Do you want everyone to look this, to not identify as anything but a member of the society? As no gender, no race? Is that what you're looking for? Because I think, not calling you this, I'm sorry, this is something that I'm seeing as the movement's kind of heading in that direction. And I don't know that I necessarily am heading in that same direction. But I'm not sure where I'm heading. So this is kind of what I'm playing with. Tooling around there. And I'm definitely interested.
I just want to make a little clarification when I said about work. When I'm talking about work, I'm talking about oppressive work. I'm talking about work that you don't own. You know what I'm saying? I'm not talking about the work that, you know, we do as enjoyment. In fact, the elimination of that type of oppressive work eliminates a sense of discipline of the body in which, you know, expresses multiple sexualities. You know, so that's where I just want to clarify that for one thing. Two, I think that one of the things you brought up in terms of gentrification, I think is really important, because if we talk about connections, I know you're doing work with Ass Pirates. I can't say that without laughing. One of the important things to look at in terms of like a place like New York City is how queerness and gender play in gentrification. If you're a young person of color who's queer, you can't afford to get your own apartment in New York City if you're making minimum wage. You know what I'm saying? So that has an effect on how you come out. Mm-hmm. B, the politics of gender within certain neighborhoods, because who needs space to express themselves to be in the big city? You know what I'm saying? You know, single women. You know what I'm saying? Single white women, mostly. Single white boys, whatever. You know what I'm saying? So these are things in which the interconnections, like to speak with what you're talking about, in terms of how we view sexuality on a larger level. And I like what you said about the politics of what you want people to express. I think that's a very key question, you know, that we really need to go, because I think that there is a danger, and I agree with you totally, there's a danger of creating this kind of what I like to call the Barbie doll effect. You know, when you see the black Barbie doll, but looks like the white Barbie doll, you know what I'm saying? It's like, you know, like Lakeisha got a, you know, dreads instead of, you know, a weave, you know, whatever, you know what I'm saying? You know, I think I'm afraid of that effect as well, you know what I'm saying, in terms of like queerness. And I think it's very prevalent within queer communities, because myself, like, as a big man, you know, physically sized big man, I've been denied access to the queer community because I don't fit into that physical stereotype of what a queer man is supposed to look like. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying? So I face a double oppression as a black man, as a fat man, as a gay man, you know what I'm saying? So I've had to like recreate my own space in order to really adjust that. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying? So that's what I I think that's a really important point that you brought up as well, in terms of physicality, how we view it in terms of, you know, our identity.